Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's EDF Engage podcast, Fourth Wave of Environmental Innovation. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note this call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to Miriam Horn from Environmental Defense Fund. Please go ahead.
Thank you and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on our new interactive podcast, EDF Engage. I'm Miriam Horn, author of Rancher Farmer Fisherman and the host of EDF Engage. A few weeks ago, EDF President Fred Krupp announced in a TED Talk that the organization will launch a satellite to measure climate warming methane emissions from oil and gas facilities around the world. What is an environmental group doing launching a satellite? That's what we're here to talk about today. From satellites to sensors, we're seeing an exciting new phase of the environmental movement, which EDF has dubbed the fourth wave of environmental innovation. Fred is here with me today. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Miriam.
Also with us is Tom Ingersoll, who has joined EDF to direct the satellite project. Tom is the former CEO of Skybox Imaging, a startup with the audacious goal of putting live, real-time satellite imagery into the hands of people everywhere, a kind of live version of Google Earth. It was an idea Google liked so much, it bought the company. Today there are 12 SkySats in space, now part of a company called Planet, working to expand our understanding of all aspects of life on Earth. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me.
We have lots to talk about, and later in the call, I want to bring all of you into the conversation. If you want to get in line to ask a question, hit the star key and then one. To reach an operator during the call, hit the star key followed by zero, or you can submit questions by email at edfengage@edf.org. Fred, a decade ago, when you conceived the idea for the book we did together, Earth the Sequel, you already saw how cutting-edge technology was transforming energy generation in ways that protected the climate. How did you get from there to recognizing this as a whole new era?
Well, I suppose, Miriam, that in the decade since we collaborated on Earth the Sequel, so much has happened. Technology keeps moving faster and faster, it seems. And it's really picked up steam and made things possible that even 10 years ago I wouldn't have imagined. Put simply, I think it's helping us make things that have been invisible for all of time visible. And when people can see pollution, they don't necessarily like it. And when they can see the effects of pollution, when the help that is made available, that's even more powerful of a motivator to clean up. So I see now the potential for producing massive streams of data previously unavailable, making a lot of our insults to the planet vivid and visible, and that empowering those of us who want to protect the planet in a way unlike what's ever happened before, not replacing those previous waves of setting aside land and enacting laws and using markets, but supercharging all of those ways. So, you know, in short, I think this is another transformational moment, a reason for hope.
Well, that's really inspiring. Can you give us a concrete example of a community that's actually seen the benefits of this fourth wave?
Well, one community is out in West Oakland. It was the first community that at first we measured methane, but then we went back in and we measured conventional pollutants, the things that make you sick, fine particles and carbon monoxide and the like. And we partnered there, again, with Google Street View cars to create these hyper-local block-by-block maps of city air pollution. It not only had never been done before, but we were able to produce maps that give the finest resolution picture of what the pollution looks like, the most finely detailed maps that exist for any city anywhere on Earth. We did that in partnership with community leaders and community groups. It helped them be part of a push to get a new law enacted in California that was enacted just this past summer to require cleanup plans for neighborhoods that are suffering from pollution like this. And it's now helping community leaders create those cleanup plans and push for better policies so that they and their children can literally breathe easier. That's the potential power of the fourth wave.
So that's fantastic that it's empowering citizens and also helping advance environmental justice goals. We're not the only group working on this, right?
Far from it, and we've learned a lot from our partners. The World Resources Institute, whose CEO I asked to come to our staff retreat a couple of years ago, talked then about satellites they were using to track deforestation in the Amazon, an interactive website that alerts local authorities when there's illegal logging going on so it can be stopped quickly. Walmart is a corporate partner that is partnering with IBM and others to make supply chains more transparent, to cut food waste and cut greenhouse gases. It used to be if they had mangoes that were contaminated, you know, they would ask their supplier, you know, where the mango came from, and they would go to the file cabinet, pull out the papers, and they'd get papers and go to the next file cabinet, and on it went. It would take 6 days. Now, when you have a mango that's contaminated, you have to take all the mangoes
in
that part of the country off the shelf because you don't know where the bad one came from. Now, using blockchain, they can find the source of the mango in 6 seconds.
Wow.
So it's really something. So anyway, I guess EDF's contribution here is, you know, we gave a name to this trend that was out there with or without us, but maybe giving it a name does help to lift people's aspirations for now with this technology, how much more powerful a tool we have to get things right.
So, Tom, I want to bring you in here. We all know Fred's been a lifelong environmentalist, but can you tell us a bit about your background?
Well, Miriam, I've been a space guy most of my career. I started out working like most aerospace engineers for a large defense contractor. But after about 10 years of that, I saw the need for the benefits to the commercial industry and began focusing most of my efforts on the commercial side, actually getting involved in commercial rockets, satellites, and supporting infrastructure for things that go to space. And most recently, I've been advising and investing in early-stage commercial space companies.
And had you seen the same trend that Fred spotted from the Silicon Valley side? Had you seen technology coming to help in solving environmental problems?
Absolutely. There are a number of venture-backed companies that are focused on greenhouse gas modeling, monitoring, climate prediction modeling, and monitoring, as well as all kinds of data analytics using a variety of technologies and platforms. There's companies in Europe, there's companies in North America, South America, all focused on this. There's startups, there's a company called Quick Start that's looking, is using hyperspectral imagery to look at a variety of greenhouse gases. There's a company in Montreal called GHGSat looking to monitor greenhouse gases. Just a variety of companies that are sprouting up around the world focused on this activity.
That's really hopeful. So, Fred, you told us about this sort of larger context of innovation, but where did the idea for a satellite come from?
No. Well, the satellite really is an extension of our campaign to reduce methane emissions. So, you know, from the beginning, most folks on the call by now know that methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's got 84 times the warming impact as carbon dioxide pound for pound in the first 20 years it's released. And over the last few years, by producing these 30 or more peer-reviewed studies that have been published, we've created a network of people who know how to measure methane using planes and helicopters, drones, Google Street View cars. Out of that came a lot of good things. You know, states changing their laws, companies responsible companies, at least, beginning to reduce emissions, and companies even helping us develop new technologies. But it was in a conversation with one of these 150 scientists that our chief scientist, Steve Hamburg, was discussing this challenge of measuring all these leaks with Steve Woofsy, who said that he'd been thinking a satellite could do it and how much more cost-effective to do it from space. And in fact, we could cover the whole globe, measure all of the sources. And that really appealed to us because the United States just emits 10% of the methane from the oil and gas industry globally. And, you know, to find the rest, really this was the only way we could do it, to go up into space. So Steve said to me, this was possible, and I said to him, let's do it. And here we are.
Never one to shy from an audacious goal, Fred. So, Tom, how did you wind up involved?
You know, I got a phone call from Steve Hamburg, the EDF chief scientist, and he was chatting with one of the CEOs that I work with, a company by the name called Spire Global. And the CEO suggested that I could potentially help with their methaneSat project. So when Steve called me, I was fascinated by what he was, you know, envisioning doing, and I was actually quite fascinated by the fact that an NGO was willing to take on such an audacious goal. And initially, I agreed to help him think through how to best go about this project and maybe help him find the right guy to go do it. But after meeting the team and understanding kind of more fully the vision and the potential impact, I offered to jump in, and I'm grateful they were willing to allow me to help out. I think was also very impressed with the broader team. In addition to all the great folks at EDF, so there's a fabulous team at Harvard and the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory that are leading all the science aspects of the project. You know, understanding the details of the atmospheric chemistry, understanding exactly what we have to go measure and the phenomenology behind those measurements is going to be real critical to our success. So we've got a great team behind us.
That's fantastic. So now I want to bring everyone who's listening in on this call into our conversation. If you want to get in line, hit the star key and then one. To reach an operator, hit the star key followed by zero. You can also submit questions by email at edfengage@edf.org. We've already had a flood of really great questions coming in. So, Tom, as people are calling in, can you tell us a bit more about what comes next? I'm guessing no one on this call has ever built a satellite or a groundbreaking sensor. How do we get from here to launch in 2021?
Well, that's a great question, Miriam, and there's lots of activity going on in that area. I think the key to any complex project is to really understand what it is you want to measure, how you're going to measure it, and then stay focused on that key objective. So many large projects, and people talk, they hear about all these cost overruns on NASA programs and DOD programs, and a lot of that is because they start chasing additional performance or additional phenomenology, and costs begin to balloon. So it's going to be important for us to stay laser focused on our key objectives. And so to detect and quantify methane emissions, we are using state-of-the-art infrared spectroscopy, and we are also leveraging a lot of the technology, the atmospheric chemistry modeling that Harvard has done. So our first phase is really about defining the instrument and understanding specifically what it is that we have to build. And from that, that'll then help us to define what the satellite will need to be, where to put the satellite, et cetera. Right now, we're planning to launch the satellite into what's known as a sun-synchronous low-Earth orbit. By sun-synchronous, it means it's flying around the poles and the sun, and it allows the satellite to have the sunlight that it's needed to detect the methane. And we expect that the satellite will be able to fly over key parts of the world every 5 or 6 days.
That's fantastic. So, again, I want to bring people into the conversation. Just a reminder that in order to get into the queue to ask a question, hit the star key and then number one. If your question is answered while you're waiting, you can remove yourself from the queue by hitting the pound key. And if you need to reach an operator, just hit the star key followed by zero. So we're really looking forward to hearing your calls. And I think we'll probably have time to get to everyone's. And so, Tom, while we're waiting for people to get on the line, let me ask you one of the questions that's been coming in over and over again via email. There are many people who seem to be technology geeks and are among our EDF supporters, and they want to just dig a little deeper into this technology. They want to know about the satellite sensitivity and resolution and just how small you can go. I'm guessing we'll be able to see leaks from big distribution pipes, but what will be the smallest size leak we'll be able to see?
Well, if we kind of unpack what we're trying to do, if you look at the ecosystem of methane detection satellites, there are a number of systems that are up flying now that are looking at sort of the macro. They're looking at very large areas in the thousands of kilometer swath, and they're trying to understand what's happening almost from a continent perspective. Then there's a number of other systems that are being postulated and built that are looking at really the micro end of it, trying to really narrow down and monitor known sources. What's missing in that ecosystem is something in between, is really something that'll map and understand where the sources are coming from, being to identify the locations and also to quantify how much methane is being emitted. And so that's what we're doing with MethaneSat at EDF. We're filling a very important missing piece of the detection and monitoring satellite ecosystem. So we're building a satellite that'll look at about a 200-kilometer swath. So as the satellite flies over a part of the world, it'll be looking at roughly a 200-kilometer. Think about it as a ribbon as you fly. And that 200-kilometer ribbon will be broken up into smaller pieces, we'll call those pixels, that are roughly 500 meters square. So we'll be able to understand what's happening in a large region, right, but also be able to understand and break up that large region into elements to understand from a facility level, from a landfill level, really where the major emissions are coming. We're not necessarily going to be able to say it's coming from this pipe or from this flange, but we will definitely be able to say it's coming from this part of the facility. In terms of just go to sensitivity, because I think that's another key part of it. Talked about resolution. The other thing that we're going to be focusing on is a very high level of sensitivity. The background methane emissions is about, or background methane in the atmosphere is about 2 parts per billion, and our objective is to measure an increase of 0.1%. So our objective is to be able to measure 2 parts per billion. So we want to be able to have a very high level of sensitivity to measure very diffuse sources, as well as emissions coming from specific sites.
Wow, that's amazing.
And that hopefully gave all the answers to the technology wonks out there.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's more lined up on the phone, and we're gonna go to the first call on the phone right now. Operator, may I have the first question?
Certainly. We'll take our first question from Hannah Hermans from New York, New York. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing this call. My question deals with methane and how this will help achieve the Paris Climate Accord. Will that help with it, or are we on track to meeting that?
Fred, you want to take that?
Well, we're not on track to meeting the Paris Accord. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And as you know, the United States is now the only nation on Earth that's not a party to the Paris Accord or has signaled its intent to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, which legally it can't do until after a few days after the next presidential election. So, no, I'm not going to say we're on track. But, yes, the methane SAT will help us because it turns out that almost 30% of the global warming that we're experiencing right now comes from human emissions from anthropogenic activities, from industry of methane. So that's the oil and gas industry is the biggest one. Coal bed methane is the second biggest. Agriculture is another big one. And the methane SAT will help us find out where the emissions were. It turns out that the International Energy Agency, based in Paris, released a report just a few months ago saying that 75% of the oil and gas methane emissions could be cost-effectively eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
When you think that 30% of our global warming is caused by this gas, and the biggest industrial source we could reduce by three-quarters, and this is a fast-acting gas, it turns out that reducing these emissions of methane is the quickest way to reduce the temperatures that we're otherwise going to see. We absolutely have to be doing everything we can to cut carbon dioxide emissions, too, because the carbon dioxide will stay up there for 100 years, and so we can't just do methane or just do carbon dioxide. We have to do both. But that's where the methane SAT, to me, is so exciting because it addresses the most tractable part of reducing the temperatures that we'll otherwise see over the next 20 years.
Hmm. Well, so let me follow up on that with some questions that came in via email on how we're going to use this for our advocacy, how we're going to use this data. People are wondering whether we're just going to immediately publish it and it will be available to everyone, or whether we're going to reach out to emitters first and give them the chance to correct things, whether we're talking to the countries and states that have taken caps and offering it to them, or how do you see us actually using this data?
Well, our commitment is just unequivocal to make it free and public and available to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get it and are confident that we've, you know, calibrated it and know what we're looking at, we're going to make it available. We will be reaching out to companies and have been for years, letting them know the satellite is coming. It's in their interest to reduce emissions before it goes up into space. For sure. So we're trying to do everything we can to give people incentives to reduce emissions.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, well, let's go back to the phone. Operator, could we have another question, please?
Certainly. We'll go next to Malcolm Bowman from Stony Brook, New York. Your line is open.
Oh, thank you. I just had a question about, you answered most of them about the resolution and sensitivity. I assume that the infrared detectors cannot see through clouds. So I was wondering about melting permafrost in the Arctic regions and how that may provide a strong background of methane emissions and whether that would be able to be picked up.
So you're right. The satellite relies on reflection from the sun, so we can't see through clouds. However, because we are going after such a high level of precision, we do believe we'll be able to pick that up. You know, again, it depends on the level of emissions, but we're hoping we can, the objective of the satellite is to be able to measure diffuse sources. So I think the short answer is yes.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure you know, there is another concern about deposits of methane hydrate in the world's oceans. I'm an oceanographer, and a lot of it's down on the continental shelves, including off the coast of Virginia, but in many other regions. And as long as that water is less than 4 degrees C at about 1,500 meters down, it'll stay frozen. So there's a concern by we oceanographers that with ocean warming, if the temperature goes up, there could be a vast new release of methane. Now, that's beyond what the satellite can do, of course, but methane certainly is a huge problem. It has a shorter half-life than CO2. It's more like 10 years rather than 100, but it's 20, 30 times more potent.
Yes, thank you.
It's putting so much emphasis on methane that it is such a potent greenhouse gas. And thank you for all that information. Fred, I want to go back to you for a minute because people are interested to know how long this satellite is going to last and how much it's going to cost to put it up there.
Well, it's really a question for Tom how long it's going to last. I think Tom has explained to me the more we're willing to spend, the longer it will stay up. But we're hoping, aspirationally, that we can get it built for $40 million. I think Tom's got some work to do. We don't have bids yet for the satellite, but we have a time frame of we're talking to different people that could build it, and we have a time frame of finalizing that by the end of August. And then we'll have, a price. Luckily, there's many people in the world of satellites and launching satellites that have expressed an interest in being involved and potentially, giving us some breaks on the cost, and that's exciting. But Tom, I'm going to let you answer the question of how long the satellite will last up in space.
We're trying to do everything to ensure that the satellite operates successfully for at least 5 years, and we're hoping that it'll go well beyond that.
Thank you. I want to remind people that you can get in on this conversation, and if you want to, that you hit the star key and then number one. And if you need to talk to the operator, you hit the star key followed by zero. I think, operator, we have another question on the line.
Yes, we'll go next to Molly McPherson from New York, New York. Your line is open.
Hi. I was wondering about other sources of methane, like feedlots. Will the EDF satellite locate and address those?
Tom, you sort of dipped into that, but can you talk specifically about feedlots and landfills and some of these other sources that we're concerned about?
Yes, I think the primary focus, and as Fred has mentioned, where we believe we can have the biggest impact would be biggest immediate impact would be oil and gas, but because of the high level of sensitivity that we're designing into the system, we should absolutely be able to assess and understand the methane contribution or emissions from feedlots, from landfills, actually from other potential agriculture sources. So absolutely we'll be able to do that. And, our objective is to be able to map the whole world every couple of months. So really get a refresh on everything that's happening in every square kilometer of the world. And with the level of precision that we're chasing, we should definitely be able to understand those elements and perhaps others.
Great, thank you. A lot of people have wondered how this satellite fits in with other satellites that are already out there, including some of NASA's satellites. Can you address that, Tom?
Yeah, I mentioned that a little bit earlier in when we were talking about resolution and the like. So I actually have been involved with some of the commercial methane detection systems. And again, their primary focus is to monitor known sources. So they're looking, think about looking through a soda straw at a very small area. And in order to find that area from space, you really have to know where it is. You have to program the satellite to look at that specific area. So those are really monitoring known sources. A lot of the other NASA satellites and European satellites are trying to understand from a very large landmass area what's going on, but not able to really quantify specifically where the methane is identified nor quantify where it's coming from. So we're trying to do really a lot of both. We're trying to map and quantify and detect all potential sources that exist on the planet, and doing so with a 200-kilometer swath as we fly over. The commercial systems are looking probably more like a 10-kilometer swath because they're kind of looking at point sources, and some of the large NASA systems are thousands of kilometer swath. So we're, again, filling that important space between one that's simply monitoring and other that's trying to understand kind of the global impact. We're trying to quantify and detect the sources at a level and precision that we can provide actionable information to those that are emitting the methane.
Thank you. Fred, we've had some questions about what this means for EDF, that if we're really digging into the fourth wave, are there new capacities that we're going to have to develop inside the organization?
Well, absolutely. And on our management team, we're trying to figure out how do we keep all the programs and all the staff up to date on the new tools and devices that are coming online, and we've got some ideas. Basically, we have to have our tentacles, so to speak, into more communities in Silicon Valley and areas of innovation. But it's going to take a deliberate effort because, you know, the world is changing quickly, and we can't assume that, you know, just osmosis or reading the newspaper will keep us up to date. But this has applications for, you know, our ecosystems program. We are involved in another satellite that EDF won't be launching, but we'll be a partner in looking at the data on evapotranspiration. We're involved in creating smart boats in, you know, we're in the early stages of bringing technology to fisheries in a way that can help conservation and protect fish stocks, keep them going. Air pollution, I mentioned, just conventional air pollution. So this making modernizing the grid, energy efficiency, there's so many applications that give us so much potential. And, you know, as I said in that TED Talk, I've been working at this stuff for a long time, and a lot of times as an environmentalist, you kind of feel like you have the wind at your face. This suite of technologies makes me feel for the first time like we've got some pretty good wind at our backs.
Let me give everyone another chance to get on the phone if you have a call, if you have a question for Fred or Tom. Again, if you want to ask a question, hit the star key and then number one. And if you need to reach the operator, hit the star key followed by zero. Fred, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of what's happening in terms of the attitudes towards science right now, and some of the federal defunding of scientific efforts, and how you see this fitting in to all of that.
I was going to say I'd be happy to, but this is not a happiest of subjects. But there is a little bit of good news in the last few days, which is that just about a week ago, we had news that the administration had decided to cut off the funding of the analysis of satellite data involved in greenhouse gas measurement and the analysis of that. And then just a couple of days ago, word came that the relevant congressional committee had voted to restore the funding. Congressman Culberson, a couple of other Texas Republican congressmen voted unanimously along with all the Democrats on the subcommittee to restore the funding. So, you know, times are tough, and I'm not going to put a happy face on it, but at least in the area of data and satellites, I think there are more and more congressmen that want to distinguish their positions from the position of the administration, which certainly at EPA and some other places has not been supportive of science.
Well, thank you. It's good to have some good news on that front. Operator, could we go to the next call, please?
Certainly. We'll take our next question from Abdulwasi Mohammed from Washington, D.C. Your line is open.
Hi, Fred and Tom. Good to talk here, talking to you. My question is for Tom. Tom, you're talking about a satellite. I'm wondering if the satellite is based on a spectrarheometer and interferometer technology, and it's perhaps that's why the cost is so high. You're talking about some range of $40 million. What if you probably have decided to go with a constellation of suite of small microsatellites like Planet have recently launched hundreds of satellites, and instead of spectrarheometer, if you probably use gas filter correlation radiometry, GFCR plus imaging, that would be very precise in detecting methane, and especially if that satellite has like a process through a capsule containing sample gas for comparison, would it not be much more powerful to detect target gas?
Well, that's a great question, and we have been doing trades around a wide range of potential instrument designs, from spectrographs to spectrometers, as well as the systems that you mentioned. There's a startup called Bluefield out of, I guess they start out of Colorado, and I think moving into Silicon Valley, that's trying to do just that. And as we've done sort of the scientific analysis and understanding the maturity of the system, I think we're finding that the GFC approach might not have the maturity that we need to be able to get the level of precision that we're looking for. And we've also looked at doing trades with microsatellites. The challenge with that is companies like GHGSat, Bluefield, and others are using microsatellites. And in so doing, you end up with a very small, I'll call it swath width, and you're also not able to get the level of precision that we need. So we're still not done with our trade, but as I've spoken with Fred about the design of the system, much of what we have to do is understand and provide input into very sophisticated atmospheric models that have been developed over a number of years with tens of millions of dollars of development work. So detecting the methane is one portion of the problem. The next portion is, okay, now that we can detect a plume of methane in the environment, where did that plume come from? And the fact that there's been winds blowing and changes in the atmosphere, et cetera, how do you invert those findings back into a point source? And so what's important for us there are very sophisticated models that exist to enable us to do that. We've got to be able to develop the level of precision in the data that we deliver into those models to be able to get the level of certainty in the output. So those are the trades that we're running. And so far, going with a constellation of small sats doesn't appear to be able to meet our objectives. I think the other point is an example that I'll use is that, if you're trying to measure the amount of emissions coming off of freeway, do you try and look at every tailpipe or do you look at the freeway? And with the way we're addressing the problem is we're, in essence, looking at the freeway. We're looking at very large swaths. We're getting a sense for, we can look at the Barnett, for example, and measure very, very diffuse emissions rather than taking very, very small pieces and then trying to aggregate them. And then I'll have to somewhat defer to the scientists who understand the complexity and the atmospheric physics that are involved here. But I know in having served on the board of directors of GHGSat, which is a methane detection company focused on the small sat and the microsatellite approach, that the approach that we're taking is very different and it's going to provide, I think, a much higher level of fidelity than is possible from small sats. But again, it's not CubeSat or MicroSat. It's a trade that's not complete yet, but that's the direction that it appears that we'll be going. Very good question. Thank you for asking.
And Tom, thank you for that answer. It makes me appreciate all over again how lucky we are to have you on board. Operator, we have another question in the queue.
Yes, we'll go next to Palo Alto, California. Your line is open.
Hi. We've talked a lot about the technical and the engineering details of this project. Fred, can you help us understand what we should be thinking about in terms of the political and social context that this data will be released into? How do we make sure that we're ready to mobilize to make good use and impact of the data that comes from this satellite?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking. The truth is there's a lot of work to be done. I would say we're ready in places like the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Europe, but we're less ready in other places. So we have 36 months or so before the satellite will be launched, and we've got a lot of work to do to get ready. But I can tell you a little bit about our thinking so far. In the United States, we've seen that presented with the data of how much methane is out there from our ground and airplane studies, we've had purple, blue, and red states act and create policies. You know, Colorado, California in the purple and blue category, Wyoming in the red category, Pennsylvania and Ohio, I guess a couple more purple states, they've all tightened up their rules, and as a result, a lot less methane is being emitted from the oil and gas sector. We've had BP and just yesterday Exxon announce targets for reducing methane emissions. Now, the International Energy Agency said we should be able to do a 75% reduction. Yesterday, Exxon said they're going to voluntarily commit to 15%, which is a good step in the right direction, but of course we want them to be more ambitious over time. So part of being ready is make the case to companies like BP, like Exxon, and like the international oil companies that operate in Saudi Arabia, Saudi Aramco is the company, of course, the national oil companies, why this is important, the data is coming, and be able to get on the ground with them now to the extent they're willing to begin to say there are science-based, engineering-based realities here. And for some of these leaks, you can actually make a profit by stopping them. For others, the cost of stopping them will be trivial. And for others, it will have a big environmental beneficial impact for a relatively small cost. So there's a lot of, in other places of the world, there will be a lot of importance placed on working with the companies. But there's an equal amount of work that has to happen with the citizens, the grassroots groups, the community groups, civil society in those countries. And, you know, to be honest, that's where we have a lot of work to do to discover who are the stakeholders there, who should we be communicating to, and even before the satellite is launched, create those relationships so everybody is ready to take advantage of the data.
Thank you, Fred. Operator, can we go to the next call, please?
Yes, ma'am. Next, we'll go to Sandra Spears from Houston, Texas. Your line is open.
Can you hear me? Can folks hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, good. I live in Houston, Texas, and I've lobbied John Culberson extensively and gotten nowhere, and it's unbelievable what they say back. And in January 2017, if you look at the bill H.R. 637 at the top, there's 110 people, and he's one of the signatures introducing that bill to overturn the Supreme Court ruling that allowed the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases.
The endangerment finding, yes. He was on the wrong side of that big time, no question, Sandy.
Right. So I have talked to him and his staff a lot. Why the sudden change? I know that he likes NASA, but I thought he's kind of like Ted Cruz, where he cares about outer space but not monitoring Earth systems. And I know one time I haven't checked a lot, he's received money from the Koch brothers. So the recent action, that amendment with Matt Cartwright to reinstate funding for carbon monitoring, does that represent something larger? Is he breaking from Koch or Trump? Or what in the world was that? I was shocked. Does anyone know?
I'm thankful for his actions, but I can't explain the motivation. You sound like you've had a lot more contact with him. I've never even met him. I just got the report that the Democrats and the Republicans on that subcommittee joined together to restore the funding. What the motivations are, you probably have a better idea than I would, but it may be signs that calls from you and others are beginning to have an effect. And I do know from many years of, you know, talking to folks on the Hill that when people are willing to engage congressmen, that over time, their positions can change. So I'm not telling you you should vote for him or you shouldn't vote for him. That's an individual decision. But I, at least on this one particular issue, he did do something we're thankful for.
Yeah, I'm grateful. Hopefully this is a sign that they can break from something. I hope this represents something larger, but I have no idea.
Cool. Well, I think that was a great note to end on, with a sign that citizen action can make a difference and that people can actually step up and do the right thing. So hopefully that will send you all off to call your congressman. And we want to thank you, Fred and Tom and all of you, for joining us on this call. We'll have a recording of the call online at blogs.edf.org/podcast. If you want additional information or a CD recording, please contact Matt Piper. You can call Matt at 212-616-1407 or email him at mpieper@edf.org. And we'll be having discussions with more EDF experts and partners on EDF Engage, so we hope you'll join us and stay tuned for more information. Thank you again.
Thank you all.